Okay, this is Joan Weaver, and I'm here with Rosetta Graff at the Kinsley Library, and we're interviewing Jerry Stapleton, December 20th, 2012, about his involvement in the 1979 tractorcade in the American agriculture movement. Okay, Jerry, can you describe your farm as it existed in 1979?
Well, how many acres? I am not recalling. I had bought two quarters of the ground from Jess Deckert, and I was trying to dry land farm. I didn't have too much machinery. I was primarily just trading work with my dad for the use of the machinery.
And did you just have crops or animals?
I had cow-calf herd that my dad had given my wife a heifer calf when we got married in 69, and we were slowly building a herd. We added about 30 heifers at one time that I had to borrow money for, and my dad said, well, at this price, thinks you can make it, so don't worry about it. But going in debt for that many critters at that period of time was pretty daunting. Luckily, it worked out. So it helped us out. I just statistically, I can't tell you exactly, but I know I've always felt like I had two good years, and then we got into the Carter years with the high interest rates, and things were really going downhill. Pretty much of a struggle. Remember at that time we were really surviving by a large garden, and here a cowman actually was resorted to milking goats to give his kids, which that was an experience in itself. That was the life went away. I never dreamed that I would have goats, much less appreciate their personalities, and I can see why they were one of the first domesticated animals that man.
How many goats did you have?
Well, too many, actually. We started with one old white Nubian that milked harder than the hubs of hell, and definitely built your arms up, but she gave a lot of milk for a goat. And she was the centerpiece of the goat herd, and she was the queen bee. Her name was Duchess, and she certainly was. She was she didn't take anything off of anybody. I'm not sure we ended up, and I sold them to a friend of mine finally when I started working in the oil patch. We just had too many for me to take care of, and take care of them like they should be, so I got rid of them. But the kids enjoyed them, and they were kind of a positive aspect, although I never thought that I would be in that situation. Did a lot of canning, big garden. And
you said you... were you working outside of the home in 79, or
not,
did it come that came later? When did you start then? This, I assume, would be to support the farm you went to work.
This was after the tractorcade in 84. Mm-hmm. I went to things really got tight, things didn't improve, but in 79 things were not looking good, and prices were down, and nothing like now, but we seemed like everything we bought, you know. JFK said that the farmer buys retail, sells wholesale, and pays the freight both ways, and even for a Democrat, he did certainly seem to have a handle on that. Actually, a personal opinion, I think he'd probably be a fairly conservative Republican now. Mm-hmm. With the way politics were going, but he did have a clue, and I do think he had a handle on it. We were kind of caught in that. I had borrowed enough money that it was some speed on the pinch. I had gone into a joint venture with my brother, I think it was 73 or 74, and we had bought some tractors and expanded the equipment to where it's a little newer, where we could farm irrigated ground a little better. We rented some ground from Lee Turner, Great Bend, which that was another experience. It's a whole other book. But
when did you start irrigating?
I'm going to say in like 74.
And that was an expensive deal too.
Yeah, we did have went into a situation with my dad's longtime landlord on one quarter, and they did put a well down, and then we put the system up, so we borrowed money for that plus the machinery. And then we rented two quarters from Lee Turner, which was a very daunting task, because Lee, in the goodness of his heart, was letting us do all the legwork for him, getting them set up and getting the systems up and getting the wells down, and we got to do a tremendous amount of uncalled for labor getting them developed. Lee was very good at that, using other people for his gain. And very time consuming at the time. Bill was very fortunate to be teaching school, but it was pretty nerve wracking getting things going. But with all of these expenses, when crop prices started turning down, and you know that inflation is a governmental policy, and it's a monetary policy. And we started hitting massive inflation, especially under Carter. There were aspects of the economy that were doing pretty good. I've heard of some of the people in the oil patch thought things were fine at that time, but nevertheless, farm notes were getting up to the 20% interest rates. I think the most that we ever paid, I think, on the operating note was 18.5. But those type of cost on top of trying to service notes became very daunting. There was a lot of people went out. Some of this might be anecdotal. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was around 12 or 15 farmers we had counted just there in the Lewis area through the Lewis Bank went under at that period of time.
This would be probably in the early 80s or
Well, that would have been the early part of Mr. Carter's tenure. I think that was probably those type of things were what was really pushing people. They could see things weren't going to get better, and they didn't. Actually got people off the tractor. You know, farmers usually just like to go tinker with stuff and work and grow things. And to get them actually involved doing something for their own perceived self-interest is sometimes very difficult.
So how did you hear about the AAM and how did that initial...
Well, my dad had taken... on a young man that was at an aunt's, this is history, that was at Mount Rose's boarding house in Wichita. His name is Lawrence Miller. And Pop said, I will have you come out and work for me if you will finish school and finish your high school education. Well, Lawrence did that, and then after high school, he started farming and putting hay business, and this is Butch's Hay Service that was he had been in with Lawrence years ago. But Lawrence never was one to let anything stop him, and he was always a mover and a shaker and always expanding, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully, but he could see that things weren't getting any better. And he had been out, heard about the farm strike out in Colorado, in southeast Colorado, and he went out there, and he to my knowledge, was probably one of the first people in all of this area that came back with a farm strike flyer and brought it by my dad's and said, you know, we need to look at this. This is not what it ought to be. Well, I had been in political science and history, and I'd taken a class in economic history. And when they started talking about parity, it kind of rang a bell, and I thought, you know, this, there's something to do with parity economics, and I think maybe we ought to look into this. Subsequently, we found Southwest Kansas around Johnson. There were some people involved, and got to looking around for any place locally, and at that time, Lewis's strike office had not opened. Bev Cornelison, and I've been trying to think of the other gentleman's name.
What was that last name?
Cornelison. She was in Larned.
How you spell that?
Bonnie Russell's sisters. Who it is, I don't know.
Okay,
C-O-R-N-E-L-I-O-N-U-S or something like that. But
we sometimes do that for the transcribers. She'll know. We'll look it up.
Now she, and I know the other gentleman, I'm blanking on his name. They were having a little strike office in an empty building that the Farmers Union of Larned had. So I went up there and manned the phones, and we were trying to help out up there. And then subsequently Lewis got active, and then we came down and started helping there. But I think most people that were involved, probably Alvin brought that up, is it just got to a tipping point that we couldn't see that things were going to be getting any better, and that we had to stand up. Primarily to implement the Farm Bill, because at that time the Farm Bill said right in there that all that had to be done was, as the Secretary of Agriculture signed it into action, as having 90% parity non-recourse loans. And it was written in the Farm Bill. All he had to do, all of that tractor cape, all of that could have been just by putting it in action.
And that was Berglund?
Bob Berglund. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met him later, and at a farmers union, this has been probably 10 or 12 years later, at a farmers union convention, and he talked all the time about parity of income. And I told him afterwards, I said, Bob, maybe you misunderstood what we were trying to get across, but parity of income is a socialist concept, and that's not what we were trying to say. We were trying to say parity pricing for agricultural products, which if you would wade through that one book that I gave you, the idea of parity pricing for agricultural products came about clear back in the 1700s with the French physiocrats, saying that to back the dollar up, or the franc, they could tie it to agricultural products. So the problem, well, even the founding fathers talked about that, because we didn't have any gold in the country when in the 13 colonies, and they did have agricultural products, but we had no way to store them. And so it was bandied about, actually backing the fledging continental with agricultural products. And as an aside, they said, well, we can't store the grain, but we can make it into whiskey, and we can store that. So that was even brought up. So of course that might have been consumed. I'm not sure whether that would have worked out or not. But the history of parity goes back a long, long ways. I was involved with Farmers Union for a while, primarily because George Peek, back in at the turn of the century, when the Farmers Union first started, really did quite a bit of research into parity too, and they were originally based upon a parity concept.
How would you define parity?
Well, parity is, you know, there are many economic designations, but parity primarily is a way to judge buying power of a product against what is being sold in the economy. 100% parity would say, okay, this has 100% buying power to get a certain basket of goods. the original Stegall Amendment in 1942 actually probably was instrumental in the recovery of the United States after World War II without having massive inflation with all the guys coming back, because it was tied into I can't recall what the name of that was, but it was tied into the bonded warehouse, the grain bin storage, and they were setting up a certain parity price on that. The original parity date, I think, was right before we went into World War I, 1916-17, because they considered that to be the golden age of economics, that things were pretty well balanced in the country, that and they said, well, a bushel of wheat was worth, in fact, this Herbert Hoover was the I guess I'd call him the czar, setting the price for the reparations, and after World War I for Germany, and he at that period of time set a value of a bushel of wheat of $2.25. Now that was the basis for all parity past that time written into law. Now, we ended up with a bastardized version later, which was 90% of 90% of 90%, which is a modern adjusted parity. They kept saying, well, you guys are so technologically good that wheat isn't worth as much. Well, that's beside the point. If the economy functions at this level, at 225, and it goes through a multiplier effect, see, it's wealth that never existed before. It came into being because of something that was grown, mm-hmm. and it's so complicated. It's so simple when you studied it. It's so simple, but it's hard to get across. But when you have that as a base, it was just like when we were on the gold standard, and at that time we were on the gold standard. But it was $2.25 a bushel of wheat, $35 for an ounce of gold. And when you take it through the economy and you have the multiplier effect, then everything is
so
operating without borrowing a bunch of money and going in debt to and having fiat money and all that. So
as the price parity, then, if the bushel of wheat was $2.25, as the rest of the rest of the goods and things went up, it was supposed to go up correspondingly, right?
Well, yeah. Ideally, it probably wouldn't have gone up at all, because everything else would have balanced out. But as people figure, right before the tractorcade, I think wheat was right at $2.25. The only thing is, all of our inputs were skyrocketing.
All of your costs.
Because we had gone to a fiat borrow head currency. And actually, when Nixon closed or opened the gold window, we were off to the $35 limit on gold. And I knew at the time I should have bought a lot of it, but I didn't have any money to do that.
No, didn't the government want you to turn all your gold in? Is the way I mean.
Well, back in the 30s, yeah. Yeah, Roosevelt had to turn it all in, but very few people were put in jail over that, so people, there mm-hmm. was some held back, but.
Yeah, I got a piece of my safety deposit box. My mother, it was a gift. I guess you could keep a gift thing. Okay, so you had heard about from the Colorado people. Did you start going to meetings?
There were strike meetings all over the place.
And by strike, what did the farmers mean?
Just to back off, say. It was, I think, primarily a thing to get people's attention. Now, we did burn some wheat.
Family?
Yeah. And, you know, dry land farming, you get cheat in it. Cheat's endemic. If you just get a little bit behind, and you've got cheat. All of our wheat had cheat in it. We burnt some wheat with cheat in it. And everybody said, well, you burnt wheat with cheat in it. Well, we would have cut it.
Yeah.
You know, and we burnt, I don't remember now, probably 40 acres of wheat. And there were some people that plowed wheat. There were some people that...
And then did you publicize you were burning it? I mean, was...
I tried. We didn't get anybody out there just to see that and take pictures, but we told people that we were burning it. Word
and
got
that
out.
Would have been in maybe 77?
Yes. Yeah, this wouldn't have been spring of 78, probably.
No, spring somewhere 78. In there, I think.
Because it was mature. Mm-hmm. I mean, we would have cut it.
Mm-hmm.
But just, I don't know, as time went along, it kind of snowballed. We got to the larger meetings that were held. People came from other states. And when Texas got involved, I don't know, but there was a lot of people from Texas got cranked up. And then, American Ag Movement paper, when it started, I'm not sure, but it was Nikki... And Nikki Nellis, I think it was Alden Nellis, in Iredale, Texas. They came up and they started writing about it and became a little weekly newspaper.
Now, as I remember, just right, that with the American Ag, you didn't pay dues or have officers or things like that? Or
it was, I guess, the original Ag version of the Tea Party. Really, we did end up, that was one of our first little schisms. There were some that were wanting to set up a new farm bureau and just do it that way and get an insurance company or whatever to help support us. And we said, hey, it's been done that way before.
And did that way not work? Or?
A lot of the, after the Tractorcade, a lot of the long-term organization, there was some discord and there were some problems with it, but they started out the American Ag Movement, Inc., and we even had a little schism here. I mean, I was a grassrooter. I said, hey, we did this grassroots, and we can have, we called them spokesmen.
Is that what Darrell Miller would have been?
One time, I ended up as... Steve Harton and I, for several years, traded back and forth. I'd be the alternate, and he'd be the spokesman, and vice versa for several years. Darrell and some of the others wanted to be the with the organized people in Texas. As things went down the road, and especially when Reagan got in, things changed and took some of the pressure off, and kind of took the wind out of the sails. But, we've had lots of movements all throughout. And, you know, you talked about Kansas populism before. There were the Grangers and the Farmers Union folks came in, and everybody had their time in the sun trying to do something about the farm problem. I don't know, a lot of the farm problem is a blessing, because we've been so dang good at it. Nobody in this country's ever had to really want.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been hungry. I mean, not to say that we haven't had hunger in this country, but overall, this population has been exceedingly blessed from never having the want that some countries have had to deal with on a continuous basis. And so you get in a situation where you, whether you have agreed to it or not, you throw your product on the open market, and if the board deems that you have an extra bushel of wheat, the price goes down. You know, when you consumed all your own production, that was a different situation, and then you had to either be have it taken or coerced from you, or talked out of it, and or given some other type of thing to, so somebody else could do something other than farm. Way back in ancient history, they said that was what a lot of the religions were for, is so to get a bushel of wheat out of the farmer.
You're tithing in wheat, huh?
I'm somewhat facetious, but I hope you see what I mean.
Yeah.
A surplus is anything past what you and your own family can consume. And when you put that on the market, I used to say when we were in the... A lot of people couldn't understand the ag movement because most urban dwellers think that we actually control the price. I remember one of the first times I was down in Washington lobbying, and I went over and over and over with the young man that was the manager of the apartment place, and that is a motel kind of, or a hotel, but not exactly. We'd rented it, I think, by the month, and people were just rotating in, and he couldn't understand what we were doing. And finally I said, well, we can't control the price. We put it on the board, and we didn't ever tell anybody. I said, it's like taking a Pontiac and putting it out there. Well, you've got, well, Pontiac's a bad thing now because they're out of business, but take a Ford and say, oh, well, you've got 100 too many Fords, and so the price goes down. Well, the car manufacturer then has the option of just shutting off and slowing down its production and controlling the production versus the market. Well, the farmer doesn't. He goes in trying to make a surplus every year. He has to, because he might have a drought, he might have bug problems, all of these things. So he goes in trying to produce the very most that he can every year. He is aimed toward producing a surplus. And then when it goes on the board, nobody asked me, but it's there. Okay, we've got too much, we've got a surplus of wheat. I've often thought, if you could put all of the production in 365 days on the board on one day, I've often thought that perhaps the price might be up a little. But we always go with perceived production. We go with production out of South America on a whole different time schedule. And we are going on a, not even a real surplus all the time, but a lot of times a perceived surplus. We think now, oh my gosh, it just dropped under $8 a bushel today on wheat. And I don't hang around very many farmers now, but I'm quite certain, knowing what they used to talk about, is, oh boy, that's a good price. Well, it's not in comparison to what fuel is, what fertilizer is, what the parts are. What, I mean, a combine now, my gosh, my renter said that, like, I'm going to guess $300,000 for a new one, perhaps more than that. That's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a used good international for $17,000, which I thought was too much. Now $300,000, oh yeah, it's like sitting in a living room easy chair. But it's still just cutting wheat, and it's a combine. It combines the old thresher and the header in one thing. It may have better air conditioning than
GPS.
God provided, but $300,000 for that and $8 a week, that still doesn't compute with them.
That was an excellent, I think, explanation that you just gave about the surplus. I had never thought that a farmer... I mean, I knew what was happening, but I'd never put it in those terms. Producing a surplus, and how do you make money in the surplus?
I mean, it's any agricultural policy, when you only have the producers at, I guess now probably around 2% of the population, you're a minority.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the ag bill now is not aimed toward the farmer. And if you go into parity economics, the whole thrust of parity economics is that is the backbone of the economy of the United States. It doesn't matter whether it's fisheries, lumber, wheat, milo, corn, beef, pork, chickens. Any of this are agricultural products that never existed before and then have come into this economic situation. If they are monetized at a certain price, they will actually stimulate the economy without borrowing money against it. And I think there is something very vital here that if we had any wisdom in Washington or in the rest of the country, I think probably would be an economic salvation for the world. But instead, we have treated a real blessing. It's just so much pottage. It's nothing. And use it as just a like a pinball game, an economic pinball game, just to satisfy things. But we've traded the monetization of actual real wealth for the monetization of debt. When Nancy Kassebaum was down there in Washington, we had got to know her very well. We were at the first public meeting that she ever went to, and we started talking to her clear back then. It's my dad and myself and just a few others that we sat out on a parking lot under a street lamp with the lights on the car so she could read some things we had, and got to know her quite well over a period of years. But she, when we were down there, they had an economic bill come up, and during conference it was added that we had monetized and had bought, I think it was something totally outrageous, like Polish war bonds. And we told her that that was put in, and, oh, it couldn't be. And she looked it up, and it was there. And that's the monetization of debt. And that's what the Fed does. That's what quantitative easing is. We are monetizing debt. When the Fed comes in and buys back our T-bills, it's the monetization of debt. This is a house of cards. This will not stand.
So Nancy did not vote for that bill then, or was there another one? I don't recall now.
That whether
she didn't vote for something that...
Yeah, that might have been, whether that was the specific thing or not. But we went in and said, you know, they've added all this. And I don't know, what we had gone down initially was is to say, look, implement this, because this is not just a selfish thing for farmers getting a price for our product. It will, it's looking out for our own perceived self-interest, no doubt about it, because it would have raised what we got. But we would have stored it and paid the storage fees on our own if we had a surplus the next year under that program. Put it back. We had storage facilities now. Put it back. Let us pay for the storage. Here's a price. It's going to help you in the long term. You're going to have a stable food supply. It's going to be there all the time. There's not that much raw material in bread. There's not that much raw material in rice-a-roni. There's more packaging for a loaf of bread than what there is wheat in the bread still. And to get that across to people, the actual outlay for parity economics at that time would have been a minuscule. We told them at the time, you think that this will cost, it will pay you in the long run, because your costs down the road are going to be outrageous in comparison. And what we were getting at is a devalued dollar. When we're talking right at this point in time of 2013 or 2014, making nickels out of stainless steel, that is devaluation of currency. We did it in when we changed from 90% silver in the dimes and the quarters and the half dollars. That's devaluation of currency. I think I'm at 65. Now, that same junk silver, 90% right now, you can go to a coin dealer, and the last that I looked, I think it was $275 for $10 face. So that's 27 to 1. Now, is silver high, or is our dollar trash? I would say it's giving you a very good indication that our dollar is trash. We have, this is why there's old curmudgeons like me that went through this, that we actually figured out to first not trust the government, because so many times liars lie, and statistics lie, and politicians are there historically forever to improve their power base, improve their power structure. I believe in the Constitution. What all of this did to me was make me more cognizant of the history classes that I took and the government classes that I took, and become more conservative, because I thought, I'm just as competent as those people are. They just are over here and they have a power structure. And when they tell me how things are and they aren't, do your homework. My God, we've got mass media now. They aren't even close friends to the truth. They are total strangers from it. And I don't care whether you're on the left wing or the right wing of the spectrum. We heard people from the left wing saying, oh, George Bush is a Nazi, and George Bush did this. Well, George Bush did things that I didn't agree with, because I am a conservative, a constitutional conservative. I believe Jefferson, that the government that governs best is the one that governs least. When I was asking for parity, I wanted a fair price, which would have been a self-leveling thing. When you're dealing with what I told you, a situation where you're always trying to grow a surplus, then there has to be some price regulator. The price regulator of parity would have not only helped me out, it would have also helped the dollar out. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Steagall Amendment earlier. I think it was 1942. It was specifically, all of the discussion about the Steagall Amendment, everything there was not to help the farmers out. It was to help monetize the dollar so we would not have massive problems after the war was over. And it worked. I think there's a very good case to say the Steagall Amendment was basic in keeping this country from having a total... I mean, look at all of the fence plants and all of the money that had been poured into those and all of the dislocations that happened because of those being shut down. And yet we had a transition from war footing to non-war footing that was really pretty well done. And a lot of it was the farmer was still had a pretty good price on his product. When Truman signed the modern adjusted parity and 90% of parity, and then I say 90 of 90, he even said later, said, I think I screwed up. He said, I should have kept Steagall Amendment in effect, because it started the value of the dollar and the inflation started going up. And we had a lot of good years through the 50s and all like that, but still, it was pretty good prices back in, as I recall, 50. It's ups and downs, and there's always been ups and downs. There was depressions in the 20s when the Fed first got out. They started playing around with money supply and got an agricultural depression that I think good old Silent Cal helped. Didn't jump in with government. Just said, hey, we can do this. It's going to take care of itself. And it did. 29 wasn't so... whole different ballgame.
All right. Okay, well, let's go back to did you drive a tractor or participate in the in the little tractorcades that were around here, like Lewis and Larned? And
yeah, we did that.
You did that. And your purpose was there just to maybe gain membership, or
and to advertise. You know, you let people know what's going on, and a little of it is to, you know, show off. The guys brought their old tractors out, and Jack Wolf would bring his stuff out and different things, and it was part social, part trying to let people know what's going on, part trying to rally the base.
Did you or your family have a tractor that went in 78 to Topeka?
No, we went down, but we didn't take a tractor down.
So you were there as part of the protest? And
yeah. My folks were at the age where they could go. I was usually fixing or doing...
Now, was this normal that of the people that were involved, where the father was maybe as militant as the son, or, you know, you were in this together? And
I think in a lot of instances, you got to remember that, my dad would have been late 60s or 70s, first 70s, but he was still very active, he had been a railroad worker and a union man, first president of the Brotherhood and Firemen and Oilers in Shawnee, Oklahoma, on the Rock Island Railroad and the roundhouse there. But he also went in when he was 16 and helped break the strike when they had a Wildcat strike. He was in there for several weeks staying in the roundhouse while they were shooting in the windows. So, he'd seen both ends of that.
Mm-hmm.
As an aside, he says there was a need for the unions. He said Franklin Roosevelt said that, check the contrast now, he said there is a need for a secret ballot so the company mm-hmm. cannot come down on the man that votes for the union. Now the unions want an open ballot so they can come down on those that don't want the union. So quite a contrast in all the intervening years.
So
he said at that time that the problem with unions is that the people that really care, the good workers, are also involved in the church, are involved in their kids' schools. He says pretty soon the union meeting is important, and it's important, and the ne'er-do-wells and the slackers and the skunks take the union over. Which I think that probably fits pretty well.
And so your dad actually was on the tractorcade that went to Washington.
Yeah.
You said
drove a pickup and
pickup, and someone else drove
your brother's tractor.
And your dad has passed and mom both went. Can you relate any stories they maybe told you of the trip or not?
As I recall, I think what they went on, there were three basic routes, and I'm trying to remember where we were on the middle or the northern route.
The middle.
We were coming through, and I think they had the snowstorm when they came through the passes through the, I don't know, it was the Cumberlands or through Virginia there somewhere, and, mm-hmm. and a lot of heavy weather and
there's slick. Sort of an outline that I made that might help your memory, but because I realize this would only be secondhand still.
Yeah.
That came from Beverly Snyder's journal.
Yeah, and Dad kept journals. If I could just find... once you get me started, you're going to regret this.
It's these two here?
Yeah.
Now, Dad kept journals. If I could get those found and go through, there's probably a wealth of information there. But...
Was he calling back home to you
at night, or
to the office?
Pretty much. I mean... just to let us know what was going on.
Let me save that question. And so.
Yeah, I know. I know my brother's tractor went, but I cannot remember that kid from Stafford that went that drove it. Dad knew him, and I'm sure that.
We may have his name somewhere, although I'm not sure. Maybe that's been a mystery with some other people we've interviewed too.
I don't think
Beverly remembered it.
I don't know.
Yeah, this. I'm sure Steve Hartnett would know. Steve Hartnett's he was the gentleman from well, he still works Stafford. He still has a.
Well, it may have been in the newspaper or something too. I might be able to find it there.
Did he? I'm not even sure.
Did he drive it off?
Did my brother even know who drove his tractor? Because all I knew it was the kid from Stafford over there that Steve and Gerald Hartnett knew, and I don't remember the kid's name at all. I heard it several times, but just.
And when the tractor got to Washington D.C., did the kid still drive it, or did your dad?
Well, he was on down there, and I think probably Dad was in his pickup most of the time down there. But Dad did tell me stories that when the snow hit down there before we got there, there was some remnant when we got there 2 weeks later. But he said they were. Some of the guys had blades on their tractors, and they were acting like snow plows and dragging fire trucks to fires and ambulances and to the hospital, and said it would have been a massive disruption in Washington, D.C. if it hadn't been for the farmers. And while we were down there, there was a number of the fire departments had thank you barbecues and thank you get-togethers for the farmers. Most of the people that were there, and even in my experience while I was there, the Capitol Hill Police and all of those folks thought it was great we were down there. Some of the reasons farmers became very distrustful of the government, and I, Clarence Bryant, and several from out west, and I've heard this from a number of people that were there. My dad, too, said that the one day on a designated parade route, one of the first days they were there, the police stopped them, and they were not Capitol Hill police. I was told by several people they had their badges taken completely over so you couldn't see their number, and a bunch of New York City cops. Hmm. Now, I was told that by a number of people. I did not witness that. But that would make you a little
nervous.
Even when things are going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of stinky. Mm-hmm. And news media at that time, I can tell you as a matter of fact, I had been over to the House building lobbying, and came back by. It was the day they let the goats out. And the goats were on the back side of the Capitol building in the fountain and on the steps, and there were chickens and goats and everything, and everybody was having a heyday. And a lot of farmers there, and I counted so many out and was blocking how many were there. And I'm guessing several thousand, upwards of 4,000 to 5,000 people there. And it came out on the news that night, 500. The Capitol Hill Police usually gave you pretty straight numbers when they had any kind of a parade or anything. And they were usually, if they said 10,000, you figured they were close. You figured if it came out on the news, if they said 10,000, it was down to 1,000. We had manipulation of the news even then. They, for their own purposes, why, I don't know. But I know the three different routes, we figured there was upwards of 10,000 people probably driving 7,000 to 8,000 support vehicles plus 5,000 tractors between the three routes. The media was saying 500 tractors. Bob Berglund believed his media, and he hid in the basement of the Department of Agriculture for 2 days. He thought we were going to come down and lynch him. Literally, we heard that from a lot of people that were there, other people that worked there. Said, yeah, he was down here for 2 days. He wouldn't leave. He thought you guys were going to get him.
And, well, you maybe did an effigy a few times, come to think of it.
Yeah, I might have been. But there was so much when the news got to St. Louis. At that time, there was a news hub in St. Louis, and got filtered down the information that we were getting back here. All the farmers had tore up the mall and they tore up lights. And I did a little bit of research on my own when I got down there, and I went over to the different buildings and got the police reports. The only damage that was done, and the news media asked the wrong questions, the only actual damage that I could ever document was a four-wheel drive tractor running into one of their $18,000 street lamps. Now, first off, they should have been asking, what in the hell are you doing with an $18,000 street lamp? They didn't ask that.
No.
This four-wheel drive tractor was being directed by six cops. And he says, I don't want to go. No, got to keep going. The rest of the damage, they said, oh, we tore up benches and burnt benches. That was documented to be done by some homeless guy out there trying to start a fire. Where there was a damage on the actual grass part of the mall, that had usually been directed by police officers to put the vehicles there. The next year, the Maryland AAM put in a bid of $1 to resuscitate the grass on the mall. And they did a better job than the parks. The people said later it was the best job they'd ever had done with the grass. But see, this is Paul Harvey's, the rest of the story. And
so you flew out and you were there in time for the actual tractor cade and everything, or did
no,
you?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I missed most of it. There were still
was
tractors there.
Was your dad there. Still there when you
yeah,
were there?
Yeah, he was there during
switch?
All that. You know, he was there all the time. He stayed there. I think that they were probably there for a couple months.
Oh, okay.
After the tractor cade.
So he would have been lobbying all that time.
Yeah.
And you flew in period about how many times?
Well, I was there two different times. Once with my family, and another one or two times just with a group of guys went down there.
And your activities included while you were there?
I was primarily lobbying because, well, I'd been in political science and just felt more comfortable with that. Most of the stuff I was doing was legwork and research and straight lobbying, trying to talk to different congressmen.
And you'd spend about a week at each time?
Yeah, usually I think it was a week. I don't remember now. It seemed like forever when you were there. I remember getting back and literally, I just don't, like Technicolor Nightmare, we got to know Nancy Kassebaum real well by then. And I remember her being in this dream nightmare and just saying, I hate this damn town. And it's a beautiful town. I mean, there's far more green areas and surprised me that it was as nice as,
well, the
as
buildings
it is.
Are beautiful.
The building. Yeah, but just the so many people there for very selfish interests. And I think that's what they never did get. The farmer, yeah, we were selfish, but we were trying to say, too, look, we're trying to help bolster your economic situation. To actually, and it wasn't feigned. I mean, from what information we'd been able to put together, it would have done that. When the basic raw materials are paid for, it has always been good times for everybody. Because it grows the pie. If you take a multiplier and if you get the money at the base, it grows the pie. It's not a bigger slice of the pie situation. I mean, you always presented with these economic arguments, well, if this one gets so much, then somebody else is going to lose. And it wouldn't have done that. But we didn't prevail.
Maybe, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but how, in talking to your mother, was there a different perception from her, or what was her life like when, did she...
Oh, Mom was a good lobbyist, too. She was an exceptional lady. Not just because she was my mom. Most people that knew her.
Mm-hmm.
She had been raised in the Friends Church at Hopewell, and she was just a very caring and giving, sweet person. And most people that she talked to down there could come up with that pretty quickly. There was no falseness or feigned anything with her. I mean, if she didn't care for you, she might tell you that. She was extremely honest. And like I said, we got to know Nancy, and probably the reason we got to know Nancy is because of my dad and mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I called when my mom passed. I called Nancy, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." She seemed to be genuinely touched.
Mm-hmm.
But so I do think that she had quite a rapport with her. And Nancy told me that she reminded me of her mother a lot. She seemed to be very honest about that. So I think Mom is probably, I mean, Pop was kind of a old, independent, damn the gunboats full speed ahead, and he got very knowledgeable and articulate where he could talk and not an ignorant or stupid man by any means, but not formally educated. Well, I can't say not formally educated, because he got an 8th grade education that probably he could quote Longfellow and things far more than
better
anything.
Education, yeah, not then.
Cram a lot more in 8 years than they do now. But
at the time, did you feel you were having any impact on the elected officials or the legislation? Or?
Oh, I think so. They might have been viewing us as a bunch of vermin crawling out of the woodwork, but I think most of them, I mean, Bob Dole, when he ran for representative, was pushing a parity platform. Now, for whatever reason, at least he knew what the nomenclature was. And I think that at least they found that they couldn't just operate in a vacuum entirely as far as the farm programs were. The Republicans, of course, at that time, went. It probably helped them.
You can get your drink of water, do you need it?
Oh, I did bring some. I just needed it. But I think looking back probably helped them politically, at least it. They could see that there was a lot of people from a lot of states that were unhappy with Carter's ag program and his monetary policy, so it probably helped. Well, it was another 4 years. I think the impact that way was...
Oh, you think it's impacted that he didn't get the second?
Yeah, because, I mean, my gosh, you don't get farmers off the farm like we did then unless something really is going on, I mean... You don't sort of say, hey, we ought to have a farm strike unless there's some reason for people actually getting involved and going. So,
yeah, that's one reason or thing that intrigued me when we were doing the other interviews and that tractor cave came up, that the stereotype I have of a farmer is not one that protests and this was a major protest.
Yeah, and I think probably history is not going to give it the credibility that it really deserved.
We're going to try.
I think there was, in retrospect, you just look at the number of people and the amount of Carter in his book said, well, if it had just stayed another 2 weeks, I would have signed it into law. Now, what an asinine thing to say. What a patronizing thing to say for anybody to write that in a book. The man is a small little man. I don't care if the press sits there and fawns on his every word. What a small little person. Now, if you either had the core belief that we should have got it, then do something about it. If not, don't sit there and patronize and say, oh, well, if you just stayed two more weeks. It was a waiting game. Mm-hmm. A lot of people had to go home. The people from the mm-hmm. South had to go home and start, whether they were cotton farmers or corn or whatever, they had to start. And they'd already taken a hit economically. They'd already gone into and spending money going down there trying to let people know what a serious situation they believe themselves to be in.
Right. And most protests are a weekend. They're not. They don't go on for months. Like.
And we did what we could. We tried to explain intellectually. We tried to explain in a humorous manner the goats and the chickens let out. We tried, and which ended up cops' pets mostly. But when to get that many people from that many different backgrounds together at one time was a phenomenal situation in itself. Mm-hmm. Then the NFO wasn't able to do it. The Farmers Union hadn't been able to do it in their time. The Grange hadn't been able to do it, although they all had their own impact. We had the Farm Bureau, which there's always been a schism there. Louisiana redneck, Roger Beale. He's a rice farmer. And he went to several different regional things. We went out to Colorado one time, and I said, well, I'm not supposed to speak, Roger. Oh, you get up here and give me some background. You back me up, man. He said he was a red-headed redneck rice farmer from Louisiana. And he called him a lot, calling me, calling my dad. And we were out there with the old firebrand from NFO trying to get across to people in the press and otherwise what all this was about. And just we have a press that when you send people through a journalism school, that doesn't mean that they're all knowing or know anything about anything. They do such a despicable job. They just kind of, you don't present the news, you present opinion and as fact, and it's just a pathetic thing, and it's going to be the downfall of this country. Political correctness and journalism.
So
what happened to the old who, what, where, when, and why? It doesn't happen.
Especially TV or book. One impact that we have never heard before, and I think you may very well be right, is that Carter didn't get a second term. There wasn't any real legislation that came out of it. Was there any other impact?
Well, the legislation was there. We just couldn't get them to implement the damn thing. And it was wrote into the Farm Bill at the time. And, farm bills are a bastardized thing anyway. I mean, I think Orville Freeman set up a deal. Well, he wanted to be fair, so he gave everybody an allotment for wheat. Well, you had the cotton farmer then started the double cropping wheat, which he hadn't before, which in the long run, unintended consequences, and we probably had more wheat mm-hmm. at that period of time than we ever had, because everybody then was growing the damn stuff. It wasn't just a regional mm-hmm. product anymore. And when you get a national farm program trying to solve problems, sometimes it's just almost humorous in the consequences that happens. But I think in the long run, we had an impact. I don't know that I could say any specific mm-hmm. things, but they knew they'd upset some people. And, that had to have an impact. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of people in urban areas that met farmers. That would have had a little impact in the long run. Well, I remember back in such and such, when farmers came down and cleaned the street up. I got a goat from that bunch of farmers down. I mean, the thing is, they found out that we weren't some just dream farmer with his cap on and an old three-wheel tractor going down the road. They had a learning process also. Because let's face it, what we have in the hills of Virginia is a whole different farm than what we have out here. Those people learn too. The southern farmers that we met, they learned what we were about out here, and we found that there were common things and common ground. So long-term impact, I think, was a lot of subtle things, but I think they existed.
And how do you feel the people back here reacted to the movement? And was there a lot of support, or were there naysayers?
Oh, I think there always are. We had people that had been involved in the NFO, and I know they had a little grudge because what they had tried to do had had an impact, but not what they'd hoped. And somebody else comes in and does something. I had worked with the Farmers Union also because of parity, and primarily afterwards, but there was a lot of people there that, yeah, we kind of agree with parity, but they didn't want to take away from their what they'd tried to do. And you have a little difficulty actually getting all the organizations headed in one direction at one time, especially when you get organized. They have their own little bailiwick and you know, no trespassing signs out. And it makes it awful hard to compromise with others. And, back of the mind, well, who are you when we try to do this? I'm gonna get a drink here. It's been two.
Well, we've kept you talking way more than you probably more used to. What do you think your dad would have said? Would he have said it was a worthwhile thing, or did you ever hear him talk about it years later that it was something he would have done again? Or
I don't. Yeah, I think so. I don't think he exactly ever stopped. It was
okay. He stayed
an avocation to him. He bought an old 770 copier that I think probably I don't know how many thousands of copies. Not only fuel alcohol, but several things he thought was he wanted to leave the world a better place, and this was important to him, not only for not necessarily a selfish thing on his point, but it was on his part, but it was for Bill and I and our kids, and he wanted to leave it in it. The more he got somewhat radical in some things, because the more he got involved, I mean, there's so many aspects of when you get started actually educating yourself about what's going on in the world, sometimes you end up with my God, how could we let this happen? Because a lot of things over a period of time, I mean, if you look what's happened in the last 50 years, people talk about all of the acts that Bush put in for after the towers. That and to take a flight now, just some of the things that incrementally we're changing in our own life. Benjamin Franklin said that those that would give up liberty for fleeting security deserve neither. I think probably he's right. There's never been a safe place on planet Earth or in human history. We can't legislate safe. We can do some things about prosperity. Capitalism and freedom has produced a country that never seriously had want. We had problems with distribution of food, but not of food itself. We had some times that were thin, but nothing like what the rest of the world is contending with. So I get a little radical as far as I think this was the fountainhead of human liberty and prosperity in this country, and I think we are killing the goose that laid the golden egg in many ways. not so just.
You're still active in politics, or?
Yeah, I've worked for local conservatives and helped Mitch Holmes get in, and I worked for Avey. Not to say that there weren't maybe some other good people, but I think that anybody that at least has read the Constitution or kind of has some inkling of what was trying to be said there needs to be supported. You can't go into a you know, people have tried this for years. The collectivist movement, even before the Bolshevik Revolution, there's been collectivist movements that, oh, we've got to do this for the poor people. Well, you know, if you let people give them the freedom to act in their own perceived self-interest and give them the freedom to sit there and do that, most people will start a restaurant, will start building this, will start doing this, will say, hey, I want to do this. You give them the actual hope, not a false little blurb to put on a TV spot. Why do you think people came to the United States for not just coming across the border from Mexico, but for hundreds of years that wanted to come here? Because it was the freedom, not any little blurb for a TV spot, but they could see that they were able to be whatever they could be. The D'Souza film that came out before this past election, what I got out of that was even in this modern day age, D'Souza saying, in India, I did not have the freedom to be what I could be. He said, I could be successful there on those terms, but he says, the only way I could be successful on my terms is to come to the United States. And we are trying to take that away. This great, they call it, social justice. Boy, there's a term that most anti-freedom thing that you can come up with. Social justice. By whose definition is social justice? There is justice, but social justice. You cannot solve everybody's problems through some all-encompassing entity. Stalin tried it. It all becomes a damning situation for all concerned. Pol Pot tried it. The killing fields, because nobody can become the perfection these people envision in their mind. That perfection does not exist. If you turn it around and put it here, you know, when we had the American Revolution, the Revolutionary Part was saying the king does not sit below God. Man sits below God. We are individuals. We give up the part of the social contract to these people to represent us, to take care of this crap that we want to continue with. And that was the social contract. That was, you can defend the borders of this country better than I can defend the borders of this country, and I'm going to give you a fat part of the power. And we have the people now having the audacity to say, I'm going to make the world a safe place for you. Just believe in me. We've had these charlatans and demagogues since the dawn of man. And poor little schlubs like me have bled to death in the ditch over them. Mm-hmm. So, you can call the Tractorcade and all like it a populist movement. A lot of it was awakening for a lot of people. Some of them went what I would consider off the deep end. I just became a conservative. Got to read my history and paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. We blind ourselves in so many ways. I was in political science. I had a class in modern political thought, and I look back and I think, my God, we were putting our blinders on even then and didn't even realize it. I don't think it was a real overt, thoughtful thing by our instructors in modern political thought. We didn't study Goldwater. What's modern conservatism except embodied by what Goldwater was saying? We didn't study him. He was laughable. He was not taken seriously by college professors in little schools in central Kansas. Now, what about KU? What about the University of Pennsylvania? I'm sure those same things, so in doing that, we have blinded our own intellectual processes to actually think. We like to think of ourselves, oh, just so, so open to everybody, unless you don't believe like me. You ever notice that?
Yeah, I noticed that.
You know, I have become, I really think that this country had the blessings of divine providence. I think the founding fathers, how could you get such an eclectic bunch of people to go through and get anything done? And they did it. It wasn't perfect. But for 200 years, it's been a damn good shot. And we're going to, out of ignorance, out of lust for power, out of lack of honor, we're going to throw it all away. Isn't that awful? Now, he started talking to a farmer. See what happens when you sit out there and think about things.
I'm just thinking, you had in college, maybe we should mention where you went to school.
Fort Hays.
Fort Hays. Yeah. And you were this poli-sci major. I'm hearing from you that maybe also this American Ag movement really helped to shape the beginnings of some of those beliefs, that could change them from maybe what you've been taught, and or augment what you've been taught, or prove what you had read anyway, maybe not taught, and that this was sort of the beginning, which has influenced your life quite a bit.
I still think that there's a lot in parity economics that we could gain from. I think there's far more here than, well, Keynesian economics has been proven wrong so many times, and we still, that's an easy way to do things, you know, quantitative easing. It won't work. Never has. Won't this time. We're going to go through a massive financial problem. I don't see any way about it. Timing, I don't know. But any time that you raise the debt by, what, 3-4 times in the space of 4 years, there's no answers there. There are only problems that you staved off.
So. Any concluding thoughts about this Tractorcade or the movement or anything I haven't asked you about? I think I pretty well.
Well, I met a bunch of good people.
You've heard that many times.
My dad really got the joy of that more than myself, because I was...
You were farming and had a young
farming
family.
Yeah. But a lot of those people are dying off now, mm-hmm. and that's, I'm sure, one reason you're
Yeah, we missed interviewing your mom and dad, which is too bad. And if you can find that journal, we'd love to see it.
I'll see what was in it. Like I say, some of those things are not exactly
public.
Well, I don't know how to put it exactly. Just, and my dad was an exceptional man, but he was also a difficult man at times, and I loved him dearly, but to just. I think in the back of my mind, I think I might be picking the scab off somewhere.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I have not I've not gone back and looked through those. I've thought several times of doing it, and since I'm retired, I probably, this is the time.
Maybe.
But,
okay, well, if there's nothing else, is there anything else you want to add?
I don't know. I've gone farther than what you planned on.
I know one thing I didn't ask you, maybe, that how did your wife feel about all this? You had a very young family when you were traipsing off.
She's a very shy person. She...
did she support you?
You've heard some you've heard some people say now is that I'm blessed far more than I deserve. Well, when I was blessed far more than I deserve with her. Sorry.
That's
emotional.
That's okay.
She was a little trooper. She's very pretty well shy and private person. She's living with me. She's got over some of that. But she was the first secretary of the WIFE organization.
She was active in WIFE.
Yeah, and she was a worker for them. And
we've heard other people say that they thought being involved in this actually strengthened marriages.
Yeah, well, she was a city girl, and I had to go to the basic training and stuck out on a farm out in the middle of nowhere with the coyotes and everything else, and she is a trooper. She worked through all that. I got a true helpmate.
That is a blessing.
Oh, yes.
And what do your kids know about this movement, and have you shared much with them? And
The two little ones, or the two older ones, they went with us at one time.
To D.C.
And I think probably Christy remembers some of it, but I'm sure it was more the Smithsonian some of the things like that. They didn't get involved directly, but I think you'd probably have to ask them if it had any impact, but I think that they could see that Pop and Merv stood up for what they believed in. They didn't just sit and take what was thrown at them. And I think the same thing for us. I think they could see that there was honor and integrity there, and a want to help others, and I think it's affected them from that standpoint. Being perhaps they weren't involved in the ag movement, but what we had to go through, they didn't even know that we were struggling. We had chickens. We had goats. Hey, this is fun. And maybe they weren't getting new stuff, but they didn't know that. They didn't feel that. They were... I think there was... most people that I have ever met don't necessarily remember the good times. They remember the struggles where you pulled together. That's what the basis, and that's where the bedrock is.
I think that might be a nice note to end on. I really do. Let me see here. I'll stop this somewhere.